Jesus save.
Mormon Mental Health is a production of Mormon Stories Podcast and the Open Stories Foundation. All donations go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards supporting its listeners. To support the podcast, please consider a donation today at mormonmentalhealth.org. And thanks for listening.
Jordan Compass came from thee.
Jesus. Welcome to another episode of Mormon Mental Health. This is Natasha Helfer Parker, and today's guest on the program is Administrator Pamela Hyde. She's the administrator of SAMHSA, which stands for the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. Ms. Hyde was nominated by President Obama and confirmed by the U.S. Senate in November of 2009. Pam is an attorney and comes to SAMHSA with more than 35 years of experience in management and consulting for public health care and human services agencies. She has served as a state mental health director, state human services director, as well as CEO of a private nonprofit managed behavioral health care firm. In 2003, she was appointed Cabinet Secretary of the New Mexico Human Services Department by Governor Bill Richardson. Hello, Pam. Nice to have you on the program.
Hi, Natasha. It's good to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's an honor to have you, and we very much appreciate your time to discuss some issues that hopefully are pertinent to mental health in general and also Mormonism. So thank you for being on. So I guess my first question is just kind of a personal one. Just tell us a little bit more about yourself versus what I just gave as far as your introduction and how you come to be in the position that you're currently in.
Thanks for that question. I actually was raised in a very strong faith community and faith family in southeastern Missouri. I had a very strong interest in healthcare issues, but I also had an opportunity early on to be exposed to a psychiatric inpatient unit, which I often talk about as being fairly impactful for me. I was there as a volunteer, what we called candy stripers back then, and I learned in that process something that was pretty profoundly impacting for me about behavioral health work, and that is that in that unit, the mother of a friend of mine at church was in the unit, and I didn't know that. Nobody was talking about it. Nobody discussed it. Wasn't something that anyone talked about. I also understood or learned that there was a young man who was the son of one of my high school teachers was there. So that experience to me was pretty profound, in that it made me understand and realize very young that mental illness is not something that happens to someone else. It's something that happens to us. It's our friends. It's our families. It's our neighbors. It's just regular people. And it's something that I also learned at the time, people don't talk about a whole lot. And unfortunately, that's a problem still today. And I've certainly worked over the last four decades to try to have mental health issues and addiction issues be more in the public eye and more understanding of people, and more willingness to understand the need to get services and treatment for those issues, the fact that they can in fact be prevented, that treatment's effective, and that people recover. So I had an early experience with this. I also have family members who have struggled with these issues, and so that has also impacted me. I think I was very interested in looking at the both the health aspect of these issues, as well as the advocacy or the legal aspects of these issues. So as I went through law school and came out the other side, I early on got an opportunity to work in a advocacy agency about these issues. So let me stop there. You can ask me more questions if you like, but that was kind of my early interaction with these kinds of issues.
No, that's really helpful to know, and I really appreciate your stating this idea that we're all affected by mental health, which is so true with all the statistics that come out with things, you know, as common as depression to things that are more unique. But I completely agree with that, and I think this is why it's so important to be discussing these topics. Well, can you give us a general overview then of SAMHSA and how it functions and what its overall goals are, and just kind of give us an inside look into that organization?
I sure can. And let me just comment about what you just said about it being important for all of us before I talk about SAMHSA. And that is that, you know, some of the best data we have says that in our lifetimes, about half of us will experience some sort of diagnosable symptoms. So that's not to say we all get diagnosed, but at some point during our lives, we will all experience a mental health substance abuse issue. And at any given time, about half of us know someone in recovery from an addiction. We may not realize that we know them, but we do. So I think the point in making that statement at this point is just to say it really is something that touches all of us. There's very few of us in this country and probably across the globe that don't have some interaction personally in our families, in our friends and circles that are touched by this issue. So SAMHSA is a federal agency that's part of the Health and Human Services Department. It's one of the smaller operating divisions, but a really critical one because we are the unique agency focused on substance abuse and mental health issues. Our mission is to reduce the impact of substance abuse and mental illness on America's communities. And we state our mission in that way because we recognize that it really truly is the health of communities and the health of our groups of people in the communities that we are focused on, and that substance abuse and mental illness can impact those communities. They're the businesses, the schools, the elected officials, the neighborhoods. So we have a huge impact, and we work to reduce that impact by at the individual level, at the family level, and at the community level.
Thank you for that. So, given your vast experience with so many of these mental health agencies and working with people, and just like you said, your personal experience with mental health issues as well, what would you say are your top concerns or priorities when it comes to the treatment of mental health issues for our citizens? Where do we start? How do we kind of make such a vast issue more, I don't know, organized? But that's probably not the best way to put it, but just how do we understand it or come to terms with some of the things that need to happen?
That's a great question. There are several things I think that worry me, or that we work really hard to address from SAMHSA, from our role here. Our efforts include providing grants to communities and states. We do a lot of surveillance work here about the numbers of people who are impacted by these issues. We do messaging and public education for the public as well as for the field. We also do some regulatory work. Our workplace drug testing program touches about 75 million people across the country. So we do a lot of different things here. And one of the things I think that we struggle with is something we talked just a little bit about already, and that is that people are so still worried about the issue of mental illness and addiction and not willing to talk about it. People don't often see it as a medical condition or a health condition, just like any other health condition. It's seen as kind of separate and apart. It's frequently seen, especially addiction, is frequently seen as a moral issue when it's not. And mental illness is often seen as either a behavior issue or a sinful issue when it's not. Addictions and mental illness are medical conditions just like any other, and they can be treated just like any other. So first and foremost, I think the thing that we are the most concerned about is the public's view of mental illness and addiction. We are really trying to get the public to understand, and the public health professionals to work with us on understanding that it's a public health issue that can be prevented, can be treated, people can recover from it, and we don't have to be ashamed of it any more than there certainly was a time when nobody wanted to talk about cancer, and there was a time when nobody wanted to talk about breast cancer, for example, and we're not there anymore. So we're hopeful that mental health and substance abuse issues will be different as well in the future. The other thing I think that we're really concerned about is being able to get the best practices available to people. So we have a lot more research we need to do. The National Institutes of Health are partners in this, and they recognize that the area of the brain and how addiction affects the brain and how mental illness affects the brain or is affected by it is a major area of research that needs to happen in the future to have better treatments, better prevention, better ways to impact these issues. And it's very complicated because it's not only brain and medical, it's also psychological and emotional. And that's an area that we really have not touched as humanity, really, in understanding those evidentiary issues. So we need more and better treatments, and we need to get people to a point where they feel comfortable reaching out and getting those treatments. Because the other thing, even though we need more treatments and more knowledge, we have a lot of information about what works. We have a lot of information about treatments that are available. We have pretty good evidence that people who get treatment actually get better. And we unfortunately also have data that tells us that only about half of the people with a mental illness get the treatment they need. And frankly, it's even worse. The numbers are even worse for substance abuse. Only about 10% of the people who have an addiction and could use treatment get it. So those are some of the things that we worry about and that we work on, trying to help the country understand it better, help the country get better access to the services that are available, and helping support our colleagues who are doing the research to try to get better treatments and services as well.
So one of the things that you mentioned quite a bit is addictions to substances. And I want to just be clear with my audience, because oftentimes in the Mormon culture, addiction is also used for issues such as pornography viewing or food or things of that nature. So could you clarify what we're actually speaking of when we speak of the addiction part of SAMHSA?
Yeah, that's a great clarification. SAMHSA is focused on addiction to substances, substance use and abuse, misuse, non-medical use of prescription drugs. It's not that we're not concerned about things like gambling addiction and others. We just are not appropriated. We don't have a lot of dollars or authorization to do that work. So we are primarily focusing in this discussion on addiction to substances, alcohol, heroin, marijuana, whatever prescription drugs, whatever substances are being inappropriately abused and used.
Thank you for that clarification, because that's something that we think as mental health professionals in the Mormon culture take a lot of time speaking about, is whether or not it's even appropriate to call some of these other things addictions or more like problematic behavior. And so that's an ongoing, challenging conversation for many of us. So you speak a lot about best practices and treatment. Can you speak a little bit about what, I know it's difficult because there's a lot of different disorders that there can be treatment for, but can you speak somewhat about what we know about best practices and treatment and what's a good place to start?
Yeah, it is, and you're right. It is hard to talk about that in general because there are so many variations. But for example, depression, you mentioned that earlier. There are a number of medications available for depression, and we know they are generally helpful, and that people who have depression and use those medications generally get better. We also know that talk therapies, cognitive behavioral therapy, and other kinds of talk therapies are, in fact, very effective. And in fact, part of what the research tells us, that combining those two things, that is medication and talk therapy, actually does better than either one of the other two alone. But the point is, there's a choice. So some people have a hard time with medications. They have a lot of side effects or it doesn't feel good to them. Other people aren't as comfortable with talk therapies, and so people have choices to do one or the other or both. And frankly, whatever the evidence is for each individual, they have to come to with their practitioner to the place where the services they're getting are working for them. The good news is there's evidence that things work, and the good news is there are choices there. So that's just one diagnosis, and there's many different kinds of depression as well. There are other diagnostic issues in mental health and mental illness where medications are available. There are other more psychosocial approaches. So, for example, for people with major mental illnesses of either psychotic disorders or others, medications do generally help. But there's also some psychosocial approaches that help deal with the functional levels and the cognitive issues that are often impacted by those illnesses. So that's also true. We also know that there's an awful lot of structural issues in our systems that are critical for example, for young people with serious emotional disorders. While medications may be helpful, there's also we have found that bringing educational approaches and family approaches and structural approaches so that the young person's world and social interactions are most effective to be helpful to them is also equally critical to them and their families. So there's a whole variety of approaches to serving people with mental health issues. And we're also learning, frankly, that for some of the more serious mental illnesses, the earlier we intervene, the better outcomes we have. And let me tell you why that's so important. If you look at some of the information about how long it is between a symptom arising for a physical health issue, for a young person, for example, and how long it takes before they actually are seen by a practitioner, it's fairly short. So if a person has a cold or asthma or a difficulty breathing or any number of other physical symptoms, they get to see a physician or a practitioner fairly quickly. For symptoms of addiction or mental illness, frankly, that can be months or even years before the symptom is identified as something that a practitioner needs to help with. And so that length of time in getting help has some implications for the person's ability to have a good outcome. So that's another reason why we want people to understand mental illness and not be afraid of it and not be afraid of people who experienced it and be willing to seek the treatment they need sooner.
When we speak about early intervention, it just kind of brings to mind adolescence and how a lot of both substance issues and also mental health disorders start kind of cropping up around this time. What can you say about, I think parents have a little bit of a challenge in the sense that in our culture, we expect adolescents to have, you know, difficult moods or going through phases, quote unquote, and so sometimes I think these things that are more what we would consider symptoms are classified as things that will just pass. Do you want to speak to that as far as how can parents better know how to get help for their teens when needed?
That also is a great question. The Institute of Medicine a few years ago put out a report on prevention of behavioral disorders among young people. And what they told us in that process was that about half of the adult mental health issues start before the age of 14. And about three quarters of them start before the age of 24. So that, again, just underscores how important it is for young people to get the services that and the interventions that they need. I think a lot of times parents identify and know, and they can see that their young person is behaving differently, is struggling differently, grades dropping quickly when they weren't having that problem before, having a different set of friends very quickly. You know, those kinds of changes in behaviors and friends and social environments and just their lives. I think parents see those things. It's just they don't know what to do about it. So I think what we are trying to encourage families, communities, educators, faith officials and others to do is learn more about mental illness, whether it's signs and symptoms of suicide or whether it's signs and symptoms of an addiction or a misuse of drugs or whether it's signs and symptoms of mental illness, and to reach out and ask questions and get help. Ask a mental health professional, find a way to connect with them, find a way to connect with family groups to get answers. And not just sit and wait. It's better to ask the question and get a, nah, that's your kid just being an adolescent answer than it is to wait 3 or 4 years when the young person could have gotten a better outcome by having a better intervention earlier.
Yeah, those are very sobering statistics. about how many start so young, and I can attest to that from my own practice as well when I go back and look at developmental histories and things of that nature when I'm doing my assessments. So that's very interesting. Okay, so let's move. This is Mormon mental health, so it's somewhat directed more to a Mormon population. What would you want to be able to communicate to the LDS population as far as knowledge or awareness as they're dealing with mental health issues in their congregations and communities, as far as anything specific more to them?
Well, first of all, I would say there are lots of strengths in what I understand to be the Mormon community. The commitment to family and community is a huge underlying strength. Family and community can be a really huge factor in maintaining mental health as well as in supporting people who are in recovery. So building on that is important. The teachings that you all practice about abstinence from habit forming and dependence creating products, I certainly was raised with that same kind of approach. And for those who actually practice that and take that seriously, then they are obviously much less likely to find themselves in addiction situations. I think the families and communities and congregations can also show their support by talking openly about mental health and, just having it be something, a topic of discussion. So many congregations and church groups will have adult groups about such things, or they will add this kind of discussion into their youth groups. So just making it okay to talk about it is important, and frankly, recognizing and being willing to state clearly that mental illness and addiction is not a result of sin or some moral condition, but really is a treatable medical condition. And faith leaders can frankly share some of their own experiences with mental health issues and with addiction issues, because there certainly are faith leaders who have those. And so those are the kinds of things I think that faith leaders can do. We actually have some specific resources for faith communities that can be found on a couple places. Mentalhealth.gov is a new website that we have set up with some other colleagues here in the federal government, which is a really great place to go for general information about mental health. SAMHSA has a website, SAMHSA.gov. And if you go into SAMHSA.gov/community conversations, there are some talking points for faith leaders and a fact sheet for faith-based congregations to use that may be helpful to you. There's some basic information and just an encouragement as a way to talk about it. So I think those are a couple things. I think the other thing that we always encourage faith leaders to do is think about their own mental health, frankly. They are often literally first responders. There are a lot of people who will go to a faith leader before they will go to a mental health professional. So knowing what to say, knowing how to interact with people who come to them, knowing where to refer them is important. And then, frankly, also knowing how to take care of themselves, because they're is some evidence that people who are in the faith-based world are exposed to so much trauma and tragedy by being these first responders that they have some of their own issues. We do know in our world that exposure to traumas and traumas of others can actually have an impact on one's own mental health. So secondary or vicarious trauma is something that's important to pay attention to. So, you know, bearing witness to other people's trauma can be both supportive to the person who is experiencing that trauma, but can also be traumatic to the people bearing witness. So we encourage people who are faith leaders to pay attention to their own mental health and get the supports that they need. There's a couple other things I might suggest. We have also evidence that faith and prayer and yoga and meditation and contemplation and sacred music, a lot of ways that faith communities support each other in their faith is also an appropriate and a good thing to do for healing effects for mental health and supportive for recovery. So Those things are all good, and we encourage people to make that connection and be clear about that. We also encourage faith communities. One thing you might want to look at is something like Mental Health First Aid, which is a public education campaign, and it's a set of curriculum, one for adults, and there's a new one that's specific around youth that actually trains people on how to recognize signs and symptoms, what to do about it, risk factors, warning signs for things like anxiety, for depression, substance use, bipolar disorder, eating disorders, and even schizophrenia. So that's another thing that faith communities could do. So there's a lot of information there. You can get a lot of information about much of that on SAMHSA.gov or on mentalhealth.gov.
Thank you for all those resources and also for pointing out the many strengths that we have within our community, which I completely agree with. And you bring up this idea of self-care for those who are on the front lines, and I'm sure you know this already, but you know, in Mormonism, those who are called as bishops or Relief Society presidents of the women's organizations or young men's and young women's leaders, we're all volunteer basis. It's all lay leadership. And so these people don't really have formal training in mental health or, you know, other types of, they're engineers or teachers or whatever their professions might be. And so I think a lot of times it's a wonderful system because we all take part in kind of the congregation's well-being. And at the same time, it can be, I think, overwhelming for those who don't maybe have the training or experience with some of these issues when they come up.
Yeah, mental health first aid is actually designed for the lay public. So it's designed not for practitioners, but for the lay public. So it's one of those things where we really recommend that volunteers, lay volunteers, actually get some training in mental health issues because they're gonna impact, they're gonna experience them. They're gonna come in front of them. So to the extent they have some information, they will be less concerned and more prepared.
Great. So let me talk a little bit about some of my concerns within the Mormon community that maybe you can speak to. I mean, the first one, I think you've already referred to several times when you've talked about mental health not being perceived as a sin. And that's probably a little bit more difficult for my audience to wrap their brains around with addiction because they do see, I guess, the experimentation of substances as sinful behavior or as wrong behavior. And I think one of the things that's coming out of the research in Mormonism is that those who kind of fit the mold and who do kind of things as they're expected to feel great, great mental health. You know, they feel accepted. They feel, you know, this great support system that's backing them up and they really truly do have it. I think the issue is more for those who tend to fall short of the expectations of Mormonism. So in other words, maybe they are dabbling with substances or maybe they're having experiences like premarital sex or they're may not as active or don't come from an active family that you know fits that kind of congregational expectation. And so those are the people that sometimes feel marginalized. And I'm concerned about, you know, what maybe are some ideas that you have for us as a general population to not lower our expectations, but when expectations aren't met, how do we really, you know, invoke that message of Christ to gather in everyone and to make everyone feel welcome, regardless of where their situations are?
You know, there's a complex interplay that we don't know enough about, but certainly the National Institute of Drug Abuse and others are doing lots of work on, which is this predisposition of certain individuals to addiction or to other kinds of mental health issues. Now, I suppose it would be great if we could sort of say, which we're getting closer to on things like breast cancer, for example, women who know they have certain kinds of histories in their families know that they are at much higher risk for breast cancer. So that means they should get screening more and things of that nature. So there are ways in which I think as we learn more about these predilections or the way genes and other kinds of things have impacts on this, the more we'll be able to say, this is a person who is more predisposed to become addicted if they use. So that that statement's pretty important. There's a difference between addiction, which is a medical condition. It literally is a change in the brain and should be seen that way. That's different than the choices people make initially about whether to use medications or inappropriately or alcohol inappropriately or illegal substances. And I'm certainly not going to get into the discussion about those behaviors and whether it's a sin or not. I can only talk about the legalities or not of it. And if you take some medications like prescription drugs, for example, where people think of them as legal, but the use of them in ways that are not prescribed or by people who are not prescribed that medication is in fact illegal. And it can in fact lead to an addiction. And then unfortunately for an addiction to opioids, for example, which may be legal opioids, but then once the addiction is there, the likelihood of moving into an illicit drug like heroin is high. So there has to be some distinctions between, for example, alcohol. It is clearly legal for adults. It's not legal for 10-year-olds and 12-year-olds and 16-year-olds. So the differences between what's legal, what's not legal, what is acceptable use for a legal drug and what is unacceptable use. So there's also unacceptable alcohol use, even if it's legal. And then what's a sin and what's not sin. These are all things that different parts of our community has to make some of their own decisions about. What we can do from a medical point of view is tell you how much alcohol is inappropriate to use, whether it's legal or not, and whether you consider it to be okay by your religion or not. So those are the kind of things that we can participate in. I can tell you that one of the things we're dealing with right now is we have some states who are moving to legalize marijuana, for example, either for recreational or medical use. And we are all struggling with the issue of, okay, what's legal, what's not legal. It's clearly not legal to do it if you're underage, no matter whether or not anyone wants to say it's harmful or not. There are clearly some evidence of some people can, in fact, get addicted. And we also have pretty good evidence that for young people, it does have impacts on educational and social and emotional growth and development. So what we try to do is make that data available. We try to make grants available to help states think about prevention efforts and helping young people see that they should wait. And then those decisions about whether one should ever use alcohol or ever use any other kind of legal drug, I think, is really up to the faith communities and the local communities to make those decisions collectively.
Well, I really appreciate you breaking that down into kind of those three areas, because I do think that one of the issues of how we dialogue about these things is to immediately move into addiction language, and that's not necessarily always appropriate. I mean, yes, there's that fear of addiction or that risk of addiction, but at the same time, there are people who use substances such as alcohol and I guess cigarette use and things like that may not always be the healthiest, but in more appropriate ways than what addiction would entail. Is that?
Yeah, and you know, there are some substances, tobacco being a great one, where there is never ever any time ever by anybody where it's healthy. It just isn't healthy to do.
Speak to cigarette use, because I've heard, and I believe it's corroborated, that it's one of the most addictive substances is nicotine.
Well, tobacco use is definitely one of the things that is most difficult to stop when you have that addiction. I think even framing it in addiction terms is relatively new. Certainly in the last few years, we have come to understand that this is a substance. A smoked cigarette is never good for your lungs, no matter how old you are and no matter in what condition. Alcohol gets a little more complicated, because for some people who are adults, for some purposes at very modest amounts, there is some evidence that it's actually not only not harmful, but maybe actually protective. So that's a little more complicated. So what we can say about alcohol is that it is legal for adults, and that there are limitations on how much any adult should have in any one day and in any given setting, regardless. So those are the kind of things we can say with that substance. For cigarettes, as I said, even though it's legal, it's not healthy, never is, never has been, never will be, not for any age, not for any purpose.
Yes, thank you for that. And then you also mentioned prescription medication, which I think is oftentimes in religious communities may even more of an issue, because it does start out as something that's legal and actually prescribed, or, you know, part of your health plan, and then it can very easily turn awry. Well, maybe I shouldn't say easily, but can you speak of that transition of how can people avoid that, I guess, that propensity to turn something that's part of your health plan into something that really can ruin your life?
Yeah, I think prescription medications are somewhat more complicated because people think of them as legal and they must be safe because a doctor prescribed them. And yet we, again, have pretty good evidence that the vast majority of people, whether young people or especially young people who are using prescription drugs non-medically, in other words, they're using them to get high or to feel good rather than to actually deal with a medical condition, most of them get that medication for free. They get it for free by getting it out of their medicine cabinet that was prescribed to their mom or their dad, and they go get it, or a friend gives it to them, or some other family member gives it to them thinking that it's not a problem. So I think for those who have the prescription for, let's say, an opioid, a pain reliever, I think a discussion with the practitioner about the what it's for, what it's not for, limitations of it, when they can stop, is there any other way to manage that pain, is an appropriate thing. And then I think for parents especially, understanding that they need to take precautions to protect those medications so they're not available to others, especially young people, is important. So we don't think about needing to lock up medications, but really we should. We should make sure they're not available to others for whom they are not prescribed. We also, frankly, need to be really careful about not saying, oh, yeah, you know, I had that pain too. I've got some leftover pills. I'll give them to you. That is seen as a friendly thing to do. It is actually not a good thing to do. If a person needs a medication for pain or other kinds of medical conditions, they really need to get it prescribed for themselves, because you never know what that individual is also taking for other purposes, or what kind of drug-drug interactions there might be, or what other kinds of medical conditions might suggest that they shouldn't be taking those medications. So I think a lot more care with prescription drugs is part of what we need to do, a lot more understanding of where people get them, and that we should be careful to keep them out of the hands of those who don't need them or shouldn't have them. And then more conversation with our practitioners about why we're being given them, what's the limitations, how can we make sure we don't get addicted in the process, et cetera. We also are working a lot with prescribers, with our colleagues here in other operating divisions within HHS, with CDC, FDA, the NIDA, our National Institute of Drug Abuse, and others, to try to make sure prescribers understand that it's not always helpful or important to provide medications for short-term pain management, that there may be other ways to do that. And then at the same time, we want to make sure that those people who need severe long-term pain management are able to get it.
Yeah, I was going to ask about the chronic pain issues, because those are oftentimes people who are on these types of medications long term, and they often deal with the stigma of being perceived as addicts.
Yeah, and I think there is a lot of good conversation going on about how to make sure that people who do, in fact, need that long-term pain support or pain relief are able to get it. Because, again, that's a medical condition like any other. It should not be people should not be ostracized. There should not be negative attitudes about that any more than anything else. And yet, at the same time, understanding that it is subject to abuse. And, again, not so much always, not always, by the person for whom it's prescribed, but by those medications falling into the hands of others, is sometimes something we need to be more explicit about protecting against.
Okay. All right. So going back to this idea of you mentioned several spiritual practices that can be very helpful towards different diagnoses, and I completely agree with that. And oftentimes, I think as mental health professionals, we're talking about an overall approach, right? A biological approach, an emotional approach, a psychosocial approach to dealing with these issues. And so going back to some of the stigmas that I think many of my clients feel is this idea that they get from their community that, you know, if you're doing the things that you should be doing spiritually, then these symptoms should go away. And, you know, I do a lot of education around that just not being realistic. Is there anything that you could say to that particular type of attitude, that if you're, you know, saying your prayers and being spiritual and going to church, that somehow you wouldn't be depressed, or that you wouldn't have anxiety, or many of these other things that we could speak to?
Well, again, I think what we know is that faith, prayer, again, other things like yoga and meditation and contemplation, sacred music, things of that nature, have healing effects. That's different than saying, if you were just spiritually right with God, you wouldn't have this medical condition. And I think that is a different kind of statement. So looking at healing effects of spiritual practices is critical. In fact, people in recovery will tell us that for a long time, I think those of us in government avoided talking about spirituality or spiritual practices because of the, you know, the need to make sure we're not promoting any particular religion. So we avoided that. And I think what we've come to understand is that some of those things can have major impacts in terms of how the recovery process works. For some people, that alone will help. But for most people, it is an adjunct, and it is a support to the medical help that they may be getting, or the clinical help they may be getting, whether it's clinical skill building or medications or other kinds of medical practices that are really critical to dealing with this medical condition. I think that's what people need to understand, is that depression is not any different than asthma or any different than high blood pressure or anything else, that there are combinations of things that can be helpful. So again, take hypertension. We know that for hypertension, you can do a lot with it to lose weight and to do more exercise and lots of things. You can do the same thing about depression. Will it take away the depression completely? Will it take away the hypertension completely? For many people, no. For many people, they will need the medication and the medical intervention to do that. So I think it's not an either or. I think that's what we have to understand. These things are not either or. They are helpful adjuncts to each other. And we just need to keep reminding ourselves that mental health issues, addiction issues, are medical conditions just like any other. And they need to be treated in that way, with a full complement. So you go to your doctor for a medical condition, he or she's going to be able to do those things that are within his scope of practice. He may or may not tell you to go home and do yoga. He may or may not tell you to go home and practice meditation. But we know that those things and healing and prayer and those things have supportive and very important adjunct help in the healing process.
One of the trends that I'm noticing, especially with some of my younger clients, and I'll even say specifically female, is this idea that medication is unhealthy. You know, so they're in running groups, or they're in community groups where with other women that are very judgmental of being on an antidepressant or an anti-anxiety or something of that nature. That if you run or exercise or have a healthy diet, it's kind of this movement towards natural means of dealing with some of the things, which again, like you're saying, those things can definitely help. But what would you say as far as those stigmas are concerned?
Again, I think there's not a one size fits all. I think for some people, and I'll, let me use hypertension again because it's very common. For some people, they can have a healthy weight, they can have healthy foods, they can exercise, they can do all kinds of things, and their blood pressure is still high. And the thing that's going to bring that blood pressure down is medication. For other people, cholesterol, hypertension, those things will have be impacted in a major positive way by doing natural things. I think natural healing is good for some people. It works for some, and it's certainly an adjunct for others. It does not work for everyone. And I think the best thing that a person can do with depression is talk to their healthcare practitioner and put a combination of things together that works for them. So again, we know that medication and talk therapy together work well. We also know that exercise helps and social supports help. So the worst thing you can do is not exercise and not have social and have social isolation. So those two things are really bad for someone who is experiencing depression. But again, I would encourage any group, I don't care whether it's an exercise group or church group or a community group, not to say there's a one size fits all for everyone, and to be understanding and supportive of the fact that each individual has to seek the help that they need in order to recover, and people can recover in many different ways. And once again, I'm just going to keep repeating this, that the mental health issues and addiction issues are medical conditions like other conditions, and they need to be treated in that way.
No, I think that bears repeating, that we need to hear that over and over again. I agree. So two quick questions more towards children, if you can address these, and then I'll try to wrap this up. I know your time is valuable. Two trends, again, that I'm seeing with parents being resistant to wanting to put their children on any type of ADHD medications, that they'll often come in and say, you know, everybody's on them. This is the only way they're treating kids who are problematic. And so even though the symptoms are very much present and the kid is struggling in school and in other areas of his or her life, there's that resistance to medicate your children. So I'd like to talk about that. And then the other kind of myth that I'll put out there for you to discuss is autism being tied to vaccinations, and now seeing a trend of not vaccinating children due to that fear.
You know, on ADHD, I think there is pretty good evidence that an awful lot of kids are being diagnosed as ADHD that may not be in need of medication for behaviors that are exhibiting. Again, I think we as a society have a tendency to be, let's get the easy approach, and the easy approach is let's give them a diagnosis and give them medication and off we are to running. So again, I think a parent has to do what we have to do about any other medical condition, which is be clear that we know the pros and cons, make sure that the diagnosis is accurate, and if we have any questions at all, to seek second opinions. There are other things to try first in terms of behavior interventions and controls, and work with the young person. On the other hand, I would hate to see parents just get into the negative feelings about ADHD and say, I never want my child on medication. It's the same kind of issue that we talked about a little earlier about the depression in adults. It really is very individual. And I encourage parents to try to think hard and long, because we don't want to over-medicate children. That's not a good thing. And there's way too many experiences that we have of young people having their behavior controlled with medication. So we do need to think about that hard, but each parent and each family needs to work with their practitioner about that, and again, go through the process that they would with any other medical condition, making sure the diagnosis is right, making sure that they know what the alternatives are, talking with the practitioner about pros and cons and choices that they have, and doing the best that they can in that setting. So with regard to the autism and immunizations, you know, this one is a difficult one. FDA is doing some work on this, and I think that what I know, and I'm not an expert in autism, so please understand that, but my understanding is that there has not been a finding of a connection between immunizations and autism. I think the problem is we as a society, and parents in particular, are struggling so hard to find out what is the cause of autism that we're looking for answers, and we just don't have them yet in terms of the causes. So FDA is doing a lot of that work. You certainly would be encouraged to think about that. I know that the National Institutes of Health are looking at autism issues, but as far as I understand, there is not a proven connection between autism and immunization at this point.
Yeah, that's my understanding as well. I think there was one study that showed it, but then that study ended up having lots of different problems, and there's been a multitude of other studies that don't show a connection. So that's, unfortunately, I think that one study got a lot of attention.
Yeah.
Okay, so I've come to the end of the majority of my questions, but I want to be able to give you an opportunity to, is there something I'm not asking, is there something I'm not addressing that you would like to speak to?
You know, I think you've asked a lot of great questions. I think we've gotten to a lot of it. I really do appreciate you and others in the faith community approaching these issues in an open way and trying to make sure that people in faith communities are comfortable and are not having the negative attitudes that the population at large does, and realizing how important faith communities are to both the identification of issues and the open conversation about issues in mental health and addiction, and also in the support and recovery of people who are experiencing those issues. So I just appreciate your work on it, and thank you to the Mormon community who listens to you for their interest.
Thank you again very much for coming on. And with that, I will close. And for those of you who would like to donate to our cause, there's a link to that on Mormon Mental Health. And thank you all for listening. And thanks again, Administrator Hyde, for being with us today.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Mental Health. To discuss this episode, please check us out at mormonmentalhealth.org. To keep the podcast alive, please consider a donation today, again, at mormonmentalhealth.org. Logo was provided by Daniel Singer. Music was generously donated by Lower Lights. Please check them out at thelowerlights.com. And thanks for listening.
Over last tempestuous sea, chart and compass came from thee. Jesus saved.